Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hope you're having a blessed day. Thursday, January the 3rd, 2019. Today is the day that the new Congress will be sworn in. I don't think it's happened yet. I think the swearing in is this evening. So at 7 a.m. this morning, Representative Nancy Pelosi, who we anticipate will become the Speaker of the House, says she does not think the Department of Justice guidance stating that a sitting president cannot be indicted is conclusive. And with that response, she becomes the highest ranking official to suggest the president could indeed be indicted while in office. Actually, I guess at noon. So that would be an hour ago now. They met for a swearing in ceremony and to vote for the speakership. So actually, it might have happened by now. I'll just admit to you, it's hard for me to keep up with everything that's happening in the middle of the day. So I apologize for that. If the swearing in has already happened, it could possibly be that we already now have a new Speaker of the House and that would be Nancy Pelosi. I promise to be absolutely more up to date on this by this time tomorrow. How's that sound? Let's talk about something else that happened over the holidays that many of us missed, but 45 million American households did not miss. Think about that for just a minute. 45 million different Netflix accounts. So that's 45 million different American households streamed the same movie over the holidays. Anybody surprised by that? I was a little surprised by that. That is a huge number, by the way. It breaks prior records. Never before have 45 million Netflix accounts streamed the same movie on its debut. Sets a new record for best ever first week for a Netflix film. What was it? It's called The Bird Box. The Bird Box is a horror concept movie. I don't know what differentiates a horror concept movie from a horror movie. So I'll just let you know. It's described as a horror concept movie. Called The Bird Box. It stars Sandra Bullock. And in it, Bullock and her children, who, by the way, are named boy and girl, are forced to wear blindfolds and navigate a river and spooky forest. I'm reading this, by the way, from Kirsten Korosek's coverage on TechCrunch. Boy and girl and Bullock wear blindfolds and navigate a river and spooky forest to protect themselves against an evil monster that, if seen, causes people to kill themselves. So what happened as people were watching this, apparently using the hashtag Bird Box Challenge on social media, people across the country started mimicking what they were seeing in the movie. And so they started blindfolding themselves and going through what would otherwise be daily tasks, some of them going out into the woods, some of them getting into boats, trying to navigate rivers, some of them pulling their hats over their eyes as they drove, and then other lunatics with them filming all of this and reposting it on social media. And apparently this became, over the holidays, while many of the rest of us were spending actual time with our families, enjoying the holidays, 45 million households were up to this nonsense. Well, it will not surprise you that lots of people ended up in the hospital, leading to Netflix having to say on Twitter, well, we don't believe we have to say this, but, and then they put in all caps, please do not hurt yourselves with the Bird Box Challenge. We don't know how it started. We appreciate the love, on and on. Don't blindfold yourself and then go out there and try to accomplish things. Which just leads me to want to talk for a moment about why people are tempted to do inane things. Why is that? Why are we tempted to do things that we actually know to be dangerous and foolish? James, in the first chapter of his book, talks about how we are tempted by our own evil desire. And that got me thinking that that means that it's somewhere within us to desire to do things that are wicked. And so it's not just the influence of the tempter, the deceiver, the enemy. There is actually something within us, something within Adam and Eve that provoked them to want to respond to the deceit of the tempter. Something within us that leads us into temptation. And James goes on to say that, you know, once that temptation, once that lust has been conceived, which that is a really interesting word that James uses, a really interesting image. What, when you think of the concept of conception, you are thinking of an actual new thing, a new life, something that is going to take on literally a life of its own. For a while, it's going to gestate within you, but at some point, it's going to give birth. And James talks about that. He talks about that progression from conception to birth. And he says, you know, once it's full grown, it gives birth again, and it gives birth to death. The wages of sin are death. There's just no question about it. There's no two ways about it, and there's no way around it. And so this got me thinking, this whole desire that we have within us to be tempted to do inane things led me to look up again, especially because these people are, you know, intentionally covering their eyes. They're intentionally, essentially blinding themselves. And I got to thinking that, you know, I felt like it had been about a year ago, and I looked it up, and it's not quite been a year. It was back in February that a young woman named Kaylee Muthart, I don't know if you remember this story, Kaylee Muthart, 21 years old, many of us were horrified by this story. It took place in Anderson, South Carolina. She was in a methamphetamine-induced psychotic episode. She'd been up for more than 48 hours. She was hallucinating wildly outside an Anderson, South Carolina church. And while people tried to restrain her, she actually gouged out her own eyes. She was squishing them in her hands as people were trying to restrain her from doing so. She's, you know, alive to tell the horror and to tell the story and to talk about redemption and to now live forever as a person who was literally made blind by her own actions, by the sin in her life, which literally gave birth to death, the death of hopes and dreams of being a marine biologist, the death of hopes and dreams of many things. And yet, when she talks about it, she talks about having a new opportunity and a fresh start. And she does, she talks about, you know, that person who was trapped in the addiction to meth, to the point that she had actually given up custody of her very young child. And now she has the opportunity for a very different but renewed relationship with her now 3-year-old daughter. And so even when things are absolutely the darkest and people have done the most horrific things to themselves and caused great pain to other people, there is redemption. There is the possibility that we would turn from darkness to light. There is the possibility that we would come to Jesus, who can actually deliver us from the penalty of sin, which is death, and the power of sin in this life. And so I wanted to lift that up today, because there are lots of biblical references to blindness, lots of biblical references to sight. We would note in his own statement of his own of his calling to ministry when Jesus sort of, you know, comes out. Jesus is sort of leadership coming out at his own synagogue in Nazareth. You know, he turned to this passage in the prophet Isaiah, and he said, "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me. The Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom to the captives, release from darkness for the prisoners, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. I think when we consider the calling of Jesus Christ, and therefore our calling as his witnesses in the world today, ambassadors of his kingdom, we can capitalize on crazy things going on in our culture, like the Bird Box Challenge, and we can say to other people, why would you be tempted to blind yourself, even momentarily with a blindfold, and try to go about even your daily activities? It's one thing to do that as a trust exercise. It's one thing to do that as an exercise in empathy toward those who are physically blind. It's another thing to do it as a social media meme, and to put other people at risk, to put yourself and other people at risk. And so please don't do it. Again, I'm with Netflix here. I can almost not believe that I have to say this, but don't do it. All right, friends, as we go to the break, let's be praying for our new Congress sworn in today. Let us pray for each of them and all of them, no matter where we find ourselves across the political spectrum. These are our members of Congress now, and they are worthy of our prayers, calling for the wisdom of God upon them. Hey, we'll be right back to continue our conversations about being, well, a conversational apologist seeking to bring the mind of Christ to bear on the headline news of our day. I'm Carmen LeBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith.
Build your kingdom here. Let the darkness fear. Show your mighty hand.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LeBurge. Let's continue with our conversations about the headline news of the day. Okay, I'll just admit to you that there are a few things that when these words appear in the headlines, I have a hard time resisting at least clicking to find out what they're talking about. So when words like sin appear in secular news headlines today, I just confess, that's particular clickbait for me, because I'm interested, as a conversational apologist, I am interested in bringing the mind of Christ to bear on the matters of the day. And if a word like sin, which a lot of folks in the church don't even want to use anymore, has made its way into secular conversations, then I feel like as a Christian, I have a really unique opportunity to lift that word up and reclaim it. Lift that word up, ask people what they think it means. Sin implies that there would be someone against whom you are sinning, or some standard against which you are sinning. To sin is to miss the mark. So what is the mark, and who establishes the mark? Those are good questions and conversations to have when you see the word sin in a headline. And you say to yourself, what headlines are you reading, Carmen, that you came across that word? Well, I got one from NBC News. I've got one from the Wall Street Journal, and I've got one from Axios. So there you go. It's a wide variety of sin stories out there today. Actually, two sin stories and one story about hell. So let me just really quickly run through these and then use them as a jumping off point for how you and I as Christians can engage our neighbors in substantive conversations today about things that are already being talked about in the world. But you and I are going to bring God's perspective to bear on those conversations. Like, we're it. You know, it's a game of tag out there in terms of, you know, whose turn is it to till the cultural conversational soil today? Well, you're it. Today, you're it. So here we go. Qatar, you know, that's over there. It's one of the Arab Emirate states. And so Qatar, it's an Islamic country. I don't know if you're aware of that. But 88% of the people who live in Qatar are not citizens of Qatar. They are what are called expats. So many of them are related to the oil industry. Lots of them are Americans. Lots of them are Europeans. And so Qatar as a country, though, is ruled as an Islamic state. And so their laws tend to be affirming of Sharia law, Islamic law. And so on New Year's Eve, rumors began spreading on social media that a part of the Qatari government called the General Authority of Customs was going to implement new taxes on things that the Qataris, by Islamic law, consider to be sin. So here we go. Here's the word sin. And here's actually a religious orientation. I mean, there's actually a substantive religious context here, and that is an Islamic state. So I'll read to you here from Caroline Radnoski's reporting for NBC News. She says Qatar welcomed the new year by implementing a 100% tax on alcohol, doubling the price overnight, sending the cost of a 12-pack of beer to $78. I'm going to tell you, you got to really want a beer to spend $78 for a 12-pack. That's some pricey Bud Light, man, or whatever it is. So I have no idea what just the first thing that came to mind. So Qatar's General Authority of Customs on January 1st applied new tax policies to tobacco products, energy drinks, a 50% tax levied on soft drinks, and pork. A 14-ounce package of bacon now costs $15. I actually don't know how that compares to the cost of bacon in America, but I know we raise a lot of pork. So I'm feeling like you and I ought to be able to afford more bacon if it's now $15 for a 14-ounce package in Qatar. Why am I telling you all this? Well, because the government actually said the tax is being, quote, applied to specific goods that the state of Qatar deems harmful to human health. So they regard it as harmful to human health because it is contrary to Islamic law. I want you to just imagine for a moment that everything that we know to be sinful or to lead to sin, imagine that overnight the government levied 100% tax on it, or even a 50% tax. Maybe things that are made with refined sugar. We know it's bad for us. We love to consume it, but we know it's bad for us. Maybe things that are made with hydrogenated oil. We know it's bad for us, but we like to consume it. I mean, pork. I mean, I'm one of those people that feels like everything in moderation is okay. So I don't know how pork is particularly harmful, unless, of course, you're applying Islamic law, which forbids the consumption of pork. So you see where this is going, right? How do we define sin? Who defines sin? How do we tax sin? How do we describe things as harmful or not harmful? So while the Qataris are levying huge taxes on things they consider to be sin, like alcohol, here in the United States, here's the headline related to my other sin headline of the day. This was from the Wall Street Journal. Sin industries could shine in 2019. We're not just talking about products here. We're talking about whole sin industries. In this case, the conversation is about marijuana and sports betting. So here we're talking about drugs that we know to be altering, gateway drugs, however you want to think about it. But we're talking about marijuana, and we're talking about the wide-scale legalization of it across the United States. We're also talking about the wide-scale legalization of sports betting. No longer will you have to go to particular states to engage in these particular activities. They will be available virtually nationwide. Now, what does do you see the difference there? What, I'm just trying to draw a comparison here. The way sin is defined in one culture, the way sin is defined in another culture, who's defining those terms, and how as a culture do we care about those things? So I'm not telling you how to engage in those conversations. I'm just suggesting that those are really great conversations for Christians to be engaged in the culture today, because sin is actually in the headlines. Okay, hell is also in the headline today. Here is the headline from Axios, and this is in relation to where we actually started the hour, and that is the new Congress. This is, says, scoop, Republicans secretly study their coming hell. Now, that is an interesting choice of terms, right? Do we even believe in hell as a culture anymore? Certainly, as Christians, We recognize the reality of hell, an eternal separation from God, an eternal reality of living in a severed, broken relationship with the full knowledge of who God is and never being able to enter into his presence, which is, you know, frankly, the joy of heaven. Something that you, by the way, I mean, people talk about hell on earth. People experience hell on earth. Absolutely. People absolutely experience a separation from God, broken relationship with him here and now. And people do experience heaven on earth, the reality of the kingdom coming and the will of God being done on earth as it is in heaven, and experiencing that right now because we actually enjoy a redeemed relationship with the living God. We actually get to live a new life in his presence, in fellowship with him. It is good and it is great and it is joyful and it is liberating and it is eternal, but it starts right now. Like, you don't have to wait for heaven or hell. I mean, they're both eternal realities, but they're also both temporal realities in no small measure. Okay, so let me read a couple of sentences from this Axios scoop from Jonathan Swan. Republicans secretly study their coming hell. Congressional Republicans are getting ready for hell, it says. Axios shares a spreadsheet that circulated through Republican circles on and off Capitol Hill. It is previewing the investigations that Democrats are likely to launch starting today, frankly. So here are some of the probes predicted. President Trump's tax returns, Trump family businesses, Trump dealings with Russia, payment to Stephanie Clifford, a.k.a. Stormy Daniels, James Comey's firing, Trump's firing of U.S. attorneys, proposed transgender ban for the military. So, I mean, it's long. The list is long, by the way. I will not belabor this point. The spreadsheet includes requests of all kinds. And it anticipates that administration officials will likely be grilled by committee members, by committee staff. They will get requests for hearings. They will get requests for sworn testimony. There will be efforts to seize communications about policies and personnel decisions. There will be subpoena threats. What they're predicting is that basically the White House will now be in a 24/7 legal defense position. That's all that will get done. Now, that's not good news for anybody. I got to tell you, that is not good for news for anybody. That's a mess. Nobody should wish or want hell for anyone else. And so if we have folks who are anticipating that their work environment is now going to, frankly, be hell, we ought to be praying ardently for them. And we ought to be, you know, people who want and desire transparency in our government and desire for good things to be happening on Capitol Hill, because, frankly, it redounds to all of us. All right, friends, I am really excited about the conversation I am about to have with Rob Cowles and Matt Roberts. In addition to being pastors of something called the Genesis Project, they are co-authors of a new book called The God of New Beginnings. If you're interested in a new beginning and actually being in a church of new beginnings, this conversation is for you. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Joining me now for conversation are two pastors. Their names are Rob Cowles and Matt Roberts. They are founding and lead pastors of something called the Genesis Project. The Genesis Project in Fort Collins, Colorado. The Genesis Project in Ogden, Utah. But really, what I will describe as a network of believers who are planting churches in what you and I might consider very dark areas. And really bringing forth places of new beginnings, no matter how broken or devastated or messy someone's life may be. So, Rob and Matt, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Thanks. So we're going to talk about the book, The God of New Beginnings, How the Power of Relationship Brings Hope and Redeems Lives. And let me start by saying, if Rob does not get choked up and cry at some point, I'm not going to feel like I did a very good job.
I cry easily.
So Rob, I'm going to start with you. Now, this is going to be a shocking question to many of our listeners. But Rob, tell us about the first time you walked into a strip club and what you experienced.
Yeah, well, the first time I walked into a strip club, it wasn't open, just to make that note. And it was overwhelming for me. I had never been to a strip club before. I mean, I'd sowed my oats earlier in my years, but that was one thing I never did. And we walked in with the owner because he had a heart to see this place redeemed for something good. And walking through, we just walked through in complete silence. And it was probably when we walked into the locker room that it was most emotional for me, as I saw just rows of lockers, and a number of those lockers had pictures of kids on them. And the reality just started setting in that a lot of these women were just doing the best they could to provide for their family, to provide for their kids. And I was just overwhelmed. Like, there was a thick smell of perfume that still to this day, if I smell that perfume, it creates an emotion in me. And I just began to cry as we walked out of the locker room and saw the stages and all these chairs around those stages. And I just pictured men my age looking at these women, many of them single moms trying to take care of their kids. It was just a breaking moment for me. And I walked out of the building and said to my boss, we have to do this. We have to plant a church here, and I want to put my name in the hat. And that got the ball rolling to what we are today. We actually are in that building in a church called Genesis Project.
And I love that your heart really, really ached when they closed the strip club, you know, one night at, you know, 2 a.m., just telling everybody, bartenders and dancers and the guys that were probably the bouncers at the door, told everyone, hey, you know, you're out of a job. We've sold the building. All of those people literally overnight lost their income. And I love how holistic your response was, that you all went out and found a donor who was willing to help folks make that transition, and that more than 20 people actually took you up on it. I really feel like the redemptive narrative contained in the story of the Genesis Project is really extraordinary. Matt, I'm going to let you jump in here to the conversation now as well. I would love for you to talk about the calling to immerse ourselves in the messy world of other people's problems.
Yeah, we believe that our calling to go begins with the person of Jesus. You know, we find in John chapter 1, verse 14, that that God became flesh and blood and came into our mess, came into our sin, came into our chaos. And that as followers of Jesus, we have been given that same call to live out incarnate lives, to be Jesus in the hardest places in our world. And that's a simple call that we try to live out. What we often say at the Genesis Project, if there was 100 rules to planning a church, we broke 99 of those. And the one thing that we've always really stood on and got right is that there's still power in the gospel presence of Jesus in the hard places. And what we find is that I think sometimes the church is so intimidated to go into hard places. Maybe fearful that we don't have the right answers, that we don't have enough resources. And relationship and love win the day so often in the hardest situations that you can imagine. That oftentimes a drug addict that has come to the very end of their rope doesn't need somebody with answers. They just need someone to be there, present, and to sit with them. That people who are going through financial hard times aren't looking for someone to bail them out and to write a check that most of us could never afford to write. They're just looking for someone to sit with them and say, hey, I'm here now and I'm not going anywhere. And at best, the church is a place that represents the presence, the coming of Jesus. And maybe most importantly, not only did he come, but he stayed and he's with us. And that's a call for our churches as the Genesis Project, is to go into hard places, not just for a week-long short-term missions trip, but to go to embed ourselves in that community and to stay even when the going gets tough.
All right, friends, my conversation partners today are Rob Cowles and Matt Roberts. They are pastors of something called the Genesis Project. You can check it out online and on Facebook. Great opportunities on Facebook to check out the Genesis Project and on all of its campuses. We're talking today about their book, The God of New Beginnings, How the Power of Relationships Brings Hope and Redeems Lives. Rob, one of the things that you talk about is owing fools the gospel. I would like for you to explain to people what that means.
I'm sorry, say that again.
How it is that we owe the gospel to fools, that we owe people this.
Yeah, you know, I look at Paul's life in Romans chapter 1. That's where Paul says that he's a debtor, that he has an obligation to, and interestingly enough, in that letter he's writing to the church in Rome, and he talks about how eager he is to go to Rome, which Rome was a very corrupt city. I mean, it was violent, it was immoral, and I look at that picture of Paul's eagerness that was born out of a sense of obligation because of what Jesus had done in his life. Paul called himself the chief of sinners, and yet Jesus reached into the mess of his life and rescued him, and so he began to live with this obligation, not a legalistic obligation, but a sense of calling to share the hope that he had experienced with others, including Rome. And when I think about Rome, it's kind of what Matt was talking about before. I think what often happens in churches today and Christians today is we want to kind of seclude ourselves and hide in a safe Christian cul-de-sac, so to speak, and protect ourselves from an evil world. Whereas when you look at Paul, he couldn't wait to go to Rome. He couldn't wait to go to this corrupt, immoral place because he knew the only hope for a city like Rome was the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's why he said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God to salvation to all who would believe. And I think Christians today need to once again rediscover the power of the simple gospel message, that it's not just the hope for Rome, it's the hope for whatever community you live in. And we've never been called to live safe. Jesus didn't come to make us safe. He came to make us dangerous, and we need to live bravely in the way of Jesus, taking this message of hope out of a sense of obligation, because we have experienced the joy of being reconciled to God. He's transformed our lives. And I think if we can really understand that, you know, one of my favorite quotes that I've heard an author say is that the problem with Christians in America is that we are not poor in spirit, we're middle class in spirit. And somehow we convince ourselves that we brought something to the table, that Jesus didn't have to do as much to reach us as he does the drug addict or the homeless person on the street. But when we come to realize that it took the same grace, it took the same sacrifice, I'm in the same boat as anyone else, boy, that transforms the way you look at other people, and you begin to live with a sense of obligation to share this hope with others.
Friends, my conversation partners today are Rob Cowles. That's the voice you just heard. I'm also talking with Matt Roberts. They are pastors of the Genesis Project. We're talking about their new book, The God of New Beginnings, How the Power of Relationships Brings Hope and Redeems Lives. Matt, I'd love to talk with you about this concept of relationships, because I think that that's certainly the foundation of what this, not only this book, but this experience that you guys are having at the Genesis Project, that's really what it's all about. And it's frankly a whole different kind of level of depth of relationship than I think most Christians have ever even imagined having with a messy person. With a person who they have already labeled and categorized as other and less than. And so help us get over some of those, you know, frankly, initial stumbling blocks to even initiating a relationship. And then tell us a story about the value of doing that.
Yeah, one of the things we say often is we have to tear down the walls of us and them, that there's no such thing as us and them. As Rob was saying, there's only us, broken people. And I think real relationships have to be immersive. Oftentimes in the context of church, we look for safe relationships that are full of boundaries. And in reality, any intimate relationship that we have is tearing down those walls and really diving into the good, bad, and the ugly. And one of my favorite stories over the last decade is the story of a young man who showed up to our church plant here in Ogden, Utah, when we were just a group of about 20, 25 people. It was clear that he was struggling with addiction. He didn't have many teeth left in his mouth. He was gaunt. He was pale, covered in tattoos from head to toe. His story seemed to be pretty clear just by looking at him. And I think it's so easy sometimes for us to just naturally be prejudiced, to assume we know somebody's story, when in reality our prejudices are often destroyed by the power of somebody's story. And this young man's name was Jay. And I invited Jay to go to lunch with me. I actually invited him to go on a mission trip with us as a church. And every time that I would ask him, he would say yes and then stand me up when I would go to pick him up. And finally, after months of pursuing this young man, we sat down at a restaurant having lunch, and he began to cry. And he said, "Man, you scare me to death, because people like you have never shown an interest in somebody like me in my life." And he kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. And we continued in that relationship. And he shared with me his story, that he was a convicted abuser of his family, that he was not only a drug addict, but a drug dealer, that as a 15-year-old, he was convicted of attempted murder by shooting a young man here in our community, that he was raised on the streets, raised in and out of prison, and come to the end of himself, come to the end of his rope, and had a radical encounter with Jesus. And what we've seen over the last 10 years is that Jesus can put back together the broken pieces that we never could. That ultimately, you and I are really, really bad saviors, that I'm not capable of saving anybody. But when we understand that our role, our job, through relationship, is to simply usher people in to the presence of Jesus, what I realize time and time again is that people like Jay, that are uncomfortable with relationships with us, are even more terrified of standing in the presence of God. And that through our relationships, we get to be people who help usher those people in to sit at the feet of Jesus and to experience his redemptive work, the power of the gospel, the power of forgiveness, the power of grace and healing. And today, Jay is a full-time pastor on our staff at the Genesis Project. He leads all of our prison and recovery ministries and has become one of the most effective ministers of the gospel that I've ever been around in my life, because he is able to live out as a picture of what the gospel is all about. It was God coming to save broken, bankrupt, desperate people like you and I. And today he's able to preach that exact same gospel through the story of his life and through the overflow of the healing that Jesus has brought to him. And that's the power of relationship, because that never happened. I mean, as much Rob and I are both pastors and preachers, and we like to think that our sermons over 35, 45 minutes on a Sunday change lives. And in reality, they are not the most powerful conduit of the gospel. Our church services, our small groups, our curriculums, the books we write, the things we say, they're all good. But man, we would contend that the most powerful conduit of the gospel from one person to another is the power of relationship.
Friends, that's the foundation and the message of this new book, The God of New Beginnings, How the Power of Relationship Brings Hope and Redeems Lives. Guys, I got to take a quick break. Can you stick with me through the break for one more question?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Great. Okay, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I'll be right back with Rob Cowles and Matt Roberts.
Grace. This is a failing love.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'm continuing my conversation with Pastors Rob Cowles and Matt Roberts of the Genesis Project. You can check it out online at the Genesis at genesisfortcollins.com, Genesis Ogden. You can check it out on Facebook as well. I love that you guys have multiple campuses, and really that this really isn't like a church planting strategy. Like, I think that if people are listening right now and thinking to themselves, oh, hey, we need a church like that in our city, we should go plant a church like that in our city, that's not so much what we're talking about as every Christian becoming this kind of Christian, that every Christian would begin relating to other people in the way that Christ relates to each and every one of us as sinners much in need of a Savior. I remember a conversation that I had, and I can't off the top of my head remember his names, but he wrote a book, maybe it's Aaron, he wrote a book called Eats with Sinners. And it's about this, you know, this whole idea that Jesus never ate a meal that he didn't eat with sinners. And Aaron Chambers, maybe is his name. And I got thinking about him as I was reading this. And I also got thinking about, I don't know if you guys have read it yet, but Darlene, and I will butcher her last name, I'm sure. It starts with a Z. Zhechk, I think is the way I'm supposed to say it. She wrote a book called The Golden Thread, Experiencing God's Presence in Every Season of Life. And it's, I'm talking with her a week from tomorrow. And so I've been reading her book, and you guys talk about the golden thread concept as well. And so anyway, I love it when I see God working in a bunch of different places in a bunch of different people's lives, but he's saying the same thing. He's pressing forward the same message into the culture, and he's doing so through multiple voices. So I just wanted to affirm that. Rob, let me ask you super directly. This concept of the wages of sin and actually seeing the real life wages of sin in people's lives, tell us how you have processed that.
Seeing, it seems like there's a trend in our culture, in the church world, where there's an idea that if you want to reach lost people, broken people, that you almost have to change the message or dampen the message, that you can't talk about sin. What we've discovered is that often the people that we're reaching out to, building relationships with, they bring up the issue of sin before we ever do, because they get firsthand that sin brings death. I mean, Paul said it, the wages of sin is death. And that's not just in an eternal perspective or even physical death. Sin brings the death of relationships. It brings the death of hope. It brings the death of freedom. And the people that when you really go after loving people in really dark places whose lives are really broken, you don't have to convince them of the ravaging nature of sin, because they're living it every day. And when they understand that, then one of the most hopeful words, it's one of my favorite words in the Bible, it's hated in our culture, but one of the best words I think there is the word repentance. It's easy to talk about repentance, because repentance just means I don't have to keep going on the same path I'm on. Because of the grace of God and the good news of Jesus, I can actually turn 180 degrees and live a life that I never dreamed possible. And so when a person's life has really been ravaged by sin, you don't have to convince them of that. And when you offer hope that you don't have to keep going the same way, that God gives you the hope of a new beginning and a new life, boy, that really becomes great news. And we've seen that happen over and over and over again. One of the greatest joys for me is on any given weekend to look out over our congregation, and there might be four, five, even six former dancers, women who used to take their clothes off in that building, now worshiping Jesus because he has transformed their lives. They've experienced the good news of the gospel.
So you have me thinking about North Avenue Presbyterian Church in Midtown Atlanta. And this goes back a number of years, but their pastor, whose name's Scott Weimer, was, you know, at home on a Saturday night and, you know, doing what pastors do on Saturday night, whatever that is. None of us really know. It's quite a mystery. And his phone rang, and it was one of his church members, one of the elders of his church, and said, turn on CNN. the churches on the news. And he turned it on, and it wasn't specifically their church that was on the news, but the corner, literally the corner. So you can see their church. I mean, it's their church sits on a full city block. And so this corner has been identified as the place in not only in Atlanta, but on the entire eastern seaboard, where more human beings are trafficked than any other place in the nation.
Wow.
And Scott talks about literally collapsing, you know, to his knees in front of the television and just weeping and crying out to God. And so when I read your testimony, Rob, about walking into that strip club for the first time and it being so dirty and so dark and recognizing this real human beings for whom Christ died that are being, you know, they're being used by other human beings. And then when you just share that you look out on a Sunday morning and there's dancers out there in the congregation and they're living redeemed lives in Jesus Christ. Scott talks about that in the context of a church that's, you know, generationally old money Atlanta. And he went into the pulpit that next Sunday morning and just did not do what he had planned to do. He just simply broke down and shared his grief with his congregation. And I think he would point to that time as when the heart of his church really changed. And,
wow.
You know, now, in addition to there being four generations of these old Atlanta families sitting in a pew, there are also women who have worked all night on the street. And there are people who have been redeemed. And there are people in his congregation who have opened their homes and taken in trafficked, you know, people who've been liberated from trafficking and on and on. So I think I want us to touch on this notion that this is the calling of the gospel for existing churches as well as for those who want to go out and plant a new church in a dark part of town. So, Matt, I'm wondering if we could conclude our conversation by you really speaking directly to other pastors of existing churches where this kind of redemptive relational reality could bring the power of the gospel to bear today.
I know oftentimes as pastors and church leaders, it's overwhelming to sit there and try to conceive and think through how you can change the culture of a church. For a lot of pastors, that's a church that's maybe been around 50, 60, 100 years. And my encouragement would be to begin with one life at a time, because relationships don't happen through church programs. Relationships don't happen through things that we dream up sitting behind a desk, but they happen out in our community. And one of the things that we found in our churches is this movement, this revival of redemption and changed life always begins with one, because when one person finds the hope and the transformative power of Jesus in their life, they can't help but share it. And a lot of times what we realize is instead of trying to change a culture, we get the opportunity to introduce a new culture into our church through lives that are actively being changed. One of the things we don't have to talk about often at the Genesis Project is evangelism, because it is just the natural outflow of somebody's life who has encountered the redemptive power of Jesus to go back out into their community and to share that hope. And so, Pastor, my encouragement to you today would be to start with one life. Go walk your neighborhood. Go ask the question, where would Jesus be in my community if he were here today? And sit down and listen to stories. Invite people into your life. And the beginning of change starts with one relationship. It begins with tearing down the walls that so often exist in our community between the sacred and the secular, and understanding that Jesus came for all of it, to redeem all
Amen.
Of it. And
guys,
to begin
I have loved,
there, to begin
I have
with
loved
one
this,
life.
But we're going to have to leave it right there because we've now run to the end of the hour. I have thoroughly enjoyed.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.